old library and his own father, everything old. Well, I know Dad's in there, but is it Dad? I mean, what if they came, changed him, made him bad, promised him something they can't give, but he thinks they can, and we go in there, and someday, 50 years from now, someone opens a book in there, and you and me drop out, like two dry moth wings on the floor, Jim. Someone pressed and hit us between pages, and no one ever guessed where we went. This was too much for Jim, who had to do something to flog his spirits. Next thing Will knew, Jim was hammering on the library door. Both hammered, frantic to jump from this night to that warmer, book-breathing night inside. Given a choice of darknesses, this one was the better. The oven smell of books as the door opened, and Dad stood with his ghost-colored hair. They tiptoed back through the deserted corridors. Will, feeling a crazy urge to whistle, as he often did past the graveyard at sundown. Dad asking what made them late, and they trying to remember all the places they hid in one day. They had hid in old garages. They had hid in old barns. They had hid in the highest trees they could climb and got bored, and boredom was worse than fear, so they came down and reported into the police chief and had a fine chat, which gave them 20 safe minutes right in the station. And Will got the idea of touring churches, and they climbed all the steeples in town and scared pigeons off the belfries, and whether or not it was safer in churches, and especially up with the bells or not, no one could claim, but it felt safe. But there again they began to get starchy with boredom, and fatigued with sameness, and were almost on the point of giving themselves up to the carnival in order to have something to do, when quite fortunately the sun went down. From sundown to now, it had taken a wonderful time, creeping upon the library, as if it were a once friendly fort that might now be manned by Arabs. "So here we are," whispered Jim, and stopped. "Why am I whispering? It's after hours, heck!" He laughed, then stopped, for he thought he heard a soft tread off in the subterranean vaults. But it was only his laughter walking back through the deep stacks on panther feet. So when they talked again, it was still in whispers. Deep forests, dark caves, dim churches, half-lit libraries were all the same. They tuned you down. They dampened your ardor. They brought you to murmurs and soft cries for fear of raising up phantom twins of your voice which might haunt corridors long after your passage. They reached the small room and circled the table on which Charles Holloway had laid out the books, where he had read many hours, and for the first time looked in each other's faces and saw a dreadful paleness, so did not comment. "From the beginning," Will's father pulled out chairs. "Please." So, each taking his part in their own good time, the boys told of the wandering by lightning rod salesman, the predictions of storms to come, the long after midnight train, the suddenly inhabited meadow, the moon-blown tents, the untouched but full-wept calliope, then the light of noon showering over an ordinary midway with hundreds of Christians wandering through, but no lions for them to be tossed to. Only to the maze where time lost itself backward and forward in waterfall mirrors, only the out-of-order carousel, the dead supper hour, Mr. Cougar, and the boy with the eyes that had seen all the glistery tripes of the world shaped like hung and dripping sins, and all the sins tenter-hooked and running red and verminous, this boy, with the eyes of a man who has lived forever, seen too much, might like to die, but doesn't know how. The boys stopped for breath. Miss Foley, the carnival again, the carousel run wild, the ancient cougar mummy gasping moonlight, exhaling silver dust, dead, then resurrected in a chair where green lightning struck his skeleton alight, all of it a storm, minus rain, minus thunder. The parade, the cigar store basement, the hiding, and at last them here finished, done with the telling. For a long moment, Will's father sat staring, blinding, into the center of the table. Then his lips moved. "Jim, Will," he said, "I believe." The boys sank in their chairs. "All of it?" "All." Will wiped his eyes. "Boy," he said gruffly, "I'm going to start bawling." "We've got no time for that," said Jim. "No time." And Will's father stood up, stuffed his pipe with tobacco, rummaged his pockets for matches, brought out a battered harmonica, a penknife, a cigarette lighter that wouldn't work, and a memo pad he had always meant to write great thoughts down on but never got around to, and lined up these weapons for a pygmy war that could be lost before it even started. Probing this idle refuse, shaking his head, he finally found a tattered matchbox, lit his pipe, and began to muse, pacing the room. "Looks like we're going to do a lot of talking about one particular carnival. Where's it come from? Where's it going? What's it up to? We thought it never hit town before. Yet, by God, look here." He tapped a yellowed newspaper ad dated October 12, 1888, and ran his fingernail along under this. J.C. Cougar and G.M. Dark present the Pandemonium Theater Company Combined Sideshows and Unnatural Museums International. "J.C. G.M.," said Jim. "Those are the same initials as on the throwaways around town this week, but it couldn't be the same men." "No?" Will's father rubbed his elbows. "My goose pimples run counter to that." He laid forth other old newspapers. 1860, 1846, same ad, same names, same initials. Dark and Cougar, Cougar and Dark. They came and went, but only once every 20, 30, 40 years, so people forgot. Where were they all the other years? Traveling. And more than traveling. Always in October. October 1846, October 1860, October 1888, October 1910, and October now, tonight. His voice trailed off. Beware the autumn people.
What?
An old religious tract. Pastor Newgate Phillips, I think. Read it as a boy. How does it go again? He tried to remember. He licked his lips. He did remember. For some, autumn comes early, stays late through life, where October follows September, and November touches October, and then, instead of December and Christ's birth, there is no Bethlehem star, no rejoicing, but September comes again, and old October, and so on down the years, with no winter, spring, or revivifying summer. For these beings, fall is the ever-normal season, the only weather. There be no choice beyond. Where do they come from? The dust. Where do they go? The grave. Does blood stir their veins? No, the night wind. What ticks in their head? The worm. What speaks from their mouth? The toad. What sees from their eye? The snake. What hears with their ear? The abyss between the stars. They sift the human storm for souls, eat flesh of reason, fill tombs with sinners. They frenzy forth. In gusts they beetle scurry, creep, thread, filter, motion, make all moons sullen, and surely cloud all clear-run waters. The spider-web hears them, trembles, breaks. Such are the autumn people. Beware of them. After a pause, both boys exhaled at once. The Autumn People, said Jim. That's them, sure. Then, Will swallowed. Does that make us summer people? Not quite. Charles Holloway shook his head. Oh, you're nearer summer than me. If I was ever a rare, fine summer person, that's long ago. Most of us are half and half. The August noon in us works to stave off the November chills. We survive by what little 4th of July wits we've stashed away. But there are times when we're all autumn people.
Not you, Dad. Not you, Mr. Holloway.
He turned quickly to see both appraising him, paleness next to paleness, hands on knees as if to bolt. It's a way of speaking. Easy, boys. I'm after the facts. Will, do you really know your dad? Shouldn't you know me, and me you, if it's going to be us'ns against them'ns?
Hey, yeah, breathed Jim. Who are you? We know who he is, darn it,
Will protested. Do we? Said Will's father. Let's see. Charles William Holloway. Nothing extraordinary about me except I'm 54, which is always extraordinary to the man inside it. Born in Sweetwater, lived in Chicago, survived in New York, brooded in Detroit, floundered in lots of places, arrived here late after living in libraries around the country all those years because I liked being alone, liked matching up in books what I'd seen on the roads. Then, in the middle of all the running away, which I called travel, in my 39th year, your mother fixed me with one glance, been here ever since. Still most comfortable in the library nights, in out of the rain of people. Is this my last stop? Chances are. Why am I here at all? Right now, it seems, to help you. He paused and looked at the two boys and their fine young faces. Yes, he said. Very late in the game. To help you. Chapter 39. Every night-blind library window chattered with cold. The man, the two boys, waited for the wind to pass away. Then Will said,
Dad, you've always helped.
Thanks, but it's not true. Charles Holloway examined one very empty hand. I'm a fool, always looking over your shoulder to see what's coming instead of right at you to see what's here. But then, for what salve it gives me, every man's a fool, which means you got to pitch in all your life, bail out, board over, tie rope, patch plaster, pat cheeks, kiss brows, laugh, cry, make do against the day you're the worst fool of all, and shout, help. Then all you need is one person's answer. I see it so clear. Across the country tonight lie cities, towns, and mere jerkwater stops of fools. So the carnival steams by, shakes any tree. It rains jackasses. Separate jackasses, I should say. Individuals with no one, they think, or no one actual to answer their help. Unconnected fools. That's the harvest the carnival comes smiling after with its threshing machine.
Oh, gosh, said Will. It's hopeless.
No. The very fact we're here worrying about the difference between summer and autumn makes me sure there's a way out. You don't have to stay foolish, and you don't have to be wrong, evil, sinful, whatever you want to call it. There's more than three or four choices. They, that dark fellow and his friends, don't hold all the cards. I could tell that today at the cigar store. I am afraid of him, but I could see he was afraid of me. So there's fear on both sides. Now, how can we use it to advantage?
How?
First things first. Let's bone up on history. If men had wanted to stay bad forever, they could have. Agreed?
Agreed.
Did we stay out in the fields with the beasts? No. In the water with the barracuda? No. Somewhere we let go of the hot gorilla's paw. Somewhere we turned in our carnivore's teeth and started chewing blades of grass. We've been working mulch as much as blood into our philosophy for quite a few lifetimes. Since then, we measure ourselves up the scale from apes, but not half so high as angels. It was a nice new idea, and we were afraid we'd lose it, so we put it on paper and built buildings like this one around it. And we've been going in and out of these buildings, chewing it over, that one new sweet blade of grass, trying to figure out how it all started, when we made the move, when we decided to be different. I suppose, one night, hundreds of thousands of years ago in a cave by a night fire, when one of those shaggy men wakened to gaze over the banked coals at his woman, his children, and thought of their being cold, dead, gone forever. Then he must have wept. And he put out his hand in the night to the woman who must die some day and to the children who must follow her. And for a little bit next morning, he treated them somewhat better, for he saw that they, like himself, had the seed of night in them. He felt that seed like slime in his pulse, splitting, making more against the day they would multiply his body into darkness. So that man, the first one, knew what we know now. Our hour is short. Eternity is long. With this knowledge came pity and mercy. So we spared others for the later, more intricate, more mysterious benefits of love. So, in sum, what are we? We are the creatures that know and know too much. That leaves us with such a burden, again we have a choice, to laugh or cry. No other animal does either. We do both, depending on the season and the need. Somehow, I feel the carnival watches to see which we're doing and how and why, and moves in on us when it feels we're ripe. Charles Holloway stopped, for the boys were watching him so intently he suddenly had to turn, flushing, away.
"Boy, Mr. Holloway," cried Jim softly, "that's great. Go on."
"Dad," said Will, amazed,
"I never knew you could talk."
"You should hear me here late nights. Nothing but talk." Charles Holloway shook his head. "Yes, you should have heard. I should have said more to you any day you name in the past. Hell, where was I? Leading up to love, I think. Yes, love." Will looked bored. Jim looked wary of the word. And these looks gave Charles Holloway pause. What could he say that might make sense to them? Could he say love was above all common cause, shared experience? That was the vital cement, wasn't it? Could he say how he felt about their all being here tonight on this wild world, running around a big sun which fell through a bigger space, falling through yet vaster immensities of space, maybe toward and maybe away from something? Could he say, we share this billion-mile-an-hour ride? We have common cause against the night. You start with little common causes. Why love the boy in a March field with his kite braving the sky? Because our fingers burn with the hot string singeing our hands. Why love some girl viewed from a train bent to a country well? The tongue remembers iron water cool on some long-lost noon. Why weep at strangers dead by the road? They resemble friends unseen in 40 years. Why laugh when clowns are hit by pies? We taste custard. We taste life. Why love the woman who is your wife? Her nose breathes in the air of a world that I know. therefore I love that nose. Her ears hear music I might sing half the night through, therefore I love her ears. Her eyes delight in seasons of the land, and so I love those eyes. Her tongue knows quince, peach, chokeberry, mint, and lime. I love to hear it speaking. Because her flesh knows heat, cold, affliction, I know fire, snow, and pain. Shared and once again shared experience. Billions of prickling textures. Cut one sense away, cut part of life away. Cut two senses, life halves itself on the instant. We love what we know. We love what we are. Common cause, common cause. Common cause of mouth, eye, ear, tongue, hand, nose, flesh, heart, and soul. But how to say it? Look, he tried. Put two men in a rail car, one a soldier, the other a farmer. One talks war, the other wheat, and bore each other to sleep. But let one spell long-distance running, and if the other once ran the mile, why, those men will run all night like boys, sparking a friendship up from memory. So all men have one business in common. Women, and can talk that till sunrise and beyond. L. Charles Holloway stopped, flushed, self-conscious again, knowing vaguely there was a target up ahead, but not quite how to get there. He chewed his lips.
Dad, don't stop, thought Will. When you talk, it's swell in here. You'll save us. Go on.
The man read his son's eyes, saw the same look in Jim, and walked slowly around the table, touching a night beast here, a clutch of ragged crones there, a star, a crescent moon, an antique sun, an hourglass that told time with bone dust instead of sand. Have I said anything I started out to say about being good? God, I don't know. A stranger is shot in the street. You hardly move to help. But if, half an hour before, you spent just 10 minutes with a fella, and knew a little about him and his family, you might just jump in front of his killer and try to stop it. Really knowing is good. Not knowing or refusing to know is bad, or amoral at least. You can't act if you don't know. Acting without knowing takes you right off the cliff. God, God, you must think I'm crazy, this talk. Probably think we should be out duck shooting. Elephant gunning balloons like you did, Will. But we got to know all there is to know about those freaks and that man heading them up. We can't be good unless we know what bad is. And it's a shame we're working against time. Show will close and the crowds go home early on a Sunday night. I feel we'll have a visit from the Autumn people then. That gives us maybe 2 hours. Jim was at the window now, looking out across the town to the far black tents and the calliope that played by the turning of the world in the night.
Is it bad?
He asked.
Bad, cried Will angrily. Bad? You ask that?
Calmly, said Will's father. A good question. Part of that show looks just great, but the old saying really applies. You can't get something for nothing. Fact is, from them, you get nothing for something. They make you empty promises. You stick out your neck and wham.
Where'd they come from? Asked Jim. Who are they?
Will went to the window with his father, and they both looked out, and Charles Holloway said to those far tents, maybe once it was just one man walking across Europe, jingling his ankle bells, a lute on his shoulder making a hunchbacked shadow, before Columbus. Maybe a man walked around in a monkey skin 1,000,000 years ago, stuffing himself with other people's unhappiness, chewed their pain all day like spearmint gum for the sweet savor, and trotted faster, revivified by personal disaster. Maybe his son after him refined his father's deadfalls, man-traps, bone-crunchers, head-achers, flesh-twitchers, soul-skinners. These laid the scum on lonely ponds from which came vinegar gnats to snuff up noses, mosquitoes to ride summer night flesh and sting forth those bumps that carnival phrenologists dearly love to fondle and prophesy upon. So, from one man here, one man there, walking as swift as his oily glances, it became scuttles of dogmen begging gifts of trouble, pandering misery, seeking under carpets for centipede treads, watchful of night sweats, hearkening by all bedroom doors to hear men twist basting themselves with remorse and warm water dreams. The stuff of nightmare is their plain bread. They butter it with pain. They set their clocks by death watch beetles and thrive the centuries. They were the men with the leather ribbon whips who sweated up the pyramids, seasoning it with other people's salt and other people's cracked hearts. They coursed Europe on the white horses of the plague. They whispered to Caesar that he was mortal, then sold daggers at half price in the grand March sale. Some must have been lazing clowns, foot props for emperors, princes, and epileptic popes. Then, out on the road, gypsies in time, their populations grew as the world grew, spread, and there was more delicious variety of pain to thrive on. The train put wheels under them, and here they run down the long road out of the Gothic and Baroque. Look at their wagons and coaches. The carving, like medieval shrines, all of it stuff once drawn by horses, mules, or maybe men. All those years, Jim's voice swallowed itself. The same people? You think Mr. Cougar, Mr. Dark are both a couple hundred years old? Riding that merry-go-round, they can shave off a year or two any time they want, right? Why, then, the abyss opened at Will's feet. They could live forever. And hurt people. Jim turned it over again and again. But why? Why all the hurt?
Because, said Mr. Holloway, you need fuel, gas, something to run a carnival on, don't you? Women live off gossip. And what's gossip but a swap of headaches, sour spit, arthritic bones, ruptured and mended flesh, indiscretions, storms of madness, calms after the storms? If some people didn't have something juicy to chew on, their choppers would prolapse, their souls with them. Multiply their pleasure at funerals, their chuckling through breakfast obituaries. Add all the catfight marriages where folks spend careers ripping skin off each other and patching it back upside down. Add quack doctors slicing persons to read their guts like tea leaves, then sewing them tight with fingerprinted thread. Square the whole dynamite factory by 10 quadrillion, and you got the black candle power of this one carnival. All the meannesses we harbor, they borrow in redoubled spades. They're a billion times itchier for pain, sorrow, and sickness than the average man. We salt our lives with other people's sins. Our flesh to us tastes sweet, but the carnival doesn't care if it stinks by moonlight instead of sun, so long as it gorges on fear and pain. That's the fuel, the vapor that spins the carousel, the raw stuffs of terror, the excruciating agony of guilt, the scream from real or imagined wounds. The carnival sucks that gas, ignites it, and chugs along its way. Charles Holloway took a breath, shut his eyes, and said, "How do I know this?" "I don't. I feel it. I taste it. It was like old leaves burning on the wind 2 nights ago. It was a smell like mortuary flowers. I hear that music.
I hear what you tell me, and half what you don't tell me. Maybe I've always dreamt about such carnivals, and was just waiting for it to come so's to see it once and nod. Now that tent show plays my bones like a marimba. My skeleton knows. It tells me. I tell you.
Chapter 40. Can they? Said Jim. I mean, do they buy souls?
Buy? When they can get them free? Said Mr. Holloway. Why, most men jump at the chance to give up everything for nothing. There's nothing we're so slapstick with as our own immortal souls. Besides, you're inferring that's the devil out there. I only say it's a type of creature has learned to live off souls, not the souls themselves. That always worried me in the old myths. I asked myself, why would Mephistopheles want a soul? What does he do with it when he gets it? Of what use is it? Stand back while I throw my own theory over the plate. Those creatures want the flaming gas off souls who can't sleep nights, that fever by day from old crimes. A dead soul is no kindling, but a live and raving soul, crisped with self-damnation, oh, that's a pretty snoutful for such as them. How do I know this? I observe. The carnival is like people, only more so. A man, a woman, rather than walk away from or kill each other, ride each other a lifetime, pulling hair, extracting fingernails, the pain of each to the other like a narcotic that makes existence worth the day. So the carnival feels ulcerated egos miles off and lopes to toast its hands at that ache. It smells boys ulcerating to be men, paining like great unwise wisdom teeth, 20,000 miles away, summer abed in winter's night. It feels the aggravation of middle-aged men like myself, who gibber after long-lost August afternoons to no avail. Need, want, desire. We burn those in our fluids, oxidize those in our souls, which jet streams out lips, nostrils, eyes, ears, broadcasts from antennae fingers. Long or short wave, God only knows, but the freak masters perceive itches and come crab clustering to scratch. It's traveled a long way on an easy map, with people handy by every crossroad to lend it lustful pints of agony to power it on. So maybe the carnival survives, living off the poison of the sins we do each other and the ferment of our most terrible regrets. Charles Holloway snorted. Good grief, how much have I said out loud, how much to myself, the last 10 minutes? You, said Jim, talk a lot. In what language, damn it, cried Charles Holloway. For suddenly it seemed he had done no more than other nights, walking exquisitely alone, deliciously propounding his ideas to halls which echoed them once, then made them vanish forever. He had written books a lifetime on the airs of vast rooms in vast buildings and had it all fly out the vents. Now it all seemed fireworks, done for color, sound, the high architecture of words, to dazzle the boys, powder his ego, but with no mark left on retina or mind after the color and sound faded. A mere exercise in self-declamation. Sheepishly, he accosted himself. How much of all this got through? 1 sentence out of 5? 2 out of 8? 3 in 1,000, said Will. Charles Holloway could not but laugh and sigh in one. Then Jim cut across with, Is it death? The carnival? The old man lit his pipe, blew smoke, seriously studied the patterns. No, but I think it uses death as a threat. Death doesn't exist. It never did, it never will. But we've drawn so many pictures of it, so many years trying to pin it down, comprehend it, we've got to thinking of it as an entity, strangely alive and greedy. All it is, however, is a stopped watch, a loss, an end, a darkness. Nothing. And the carnival wisely knows we're more afraid of nothing than we are of something. You can fight something, but nothing? Where do you hit it? Has it a heart, soul, butt behind, brain? No, no. So the carnival just shakes a great croupier's cup full of nothing at us, and reaps us as we tumble back head over heels in fright. Oh, it shows us something that might eventually lead to nothing, all right. That flourish of mirrors out there in the meadow, that's a raw something for sure. Enough to knock your soul sideways in the saddle. It's a hit below the belt to see yourself 90 years gone, the vapors of eternity rising from you like breath off dry ice. Then, when it's frozen you stiff, it plays that fine, sweet, soul-searching music that smells of fresh-washed frocks of women dancing on backyard lines in May, that sounds like haystacks trampled into wine. All that blue sky and summer night on the lake kind of tune until your head bangs with the drums that look like full moons beating around the calliope. Simplicity. Lord, I do admire their direct approach. Hit an old man with mirrors. Watch his pieces fall in jigsaws of ice only the carnival can put together again. How? Waltz around back on the carousel to beautiful Ohio or Merry Widow. But they're careful not to tell one thing to people who go riding to its music. What? Asked Jim. Why, that if you're a miserable sinner in one shape, you're a miserable sinner in another. Changing size doesn't change the brain. If I made you 25 tomorrow, Jim, your thoughts would still be boy thoughts. And it'd show. Or if they turned me into a boy of 10 this instant, my brain would still be 50, and that boy would act funnier and older and weirder than any boy ever. Then, too, time's out of joint another way. Which way? Asked Will. If I became young again, all my friends would still be 50, 60, wouldn't they? I'd be cut off from them forever. For I couldn't tell them what I'd up and done, could I? They'd resent it. They'd hate me. Their interests would no longer be mine, would they? Especially their worries. Sickness and death for them. New life for me. So where's the place in this world for a man who looks 20 but who is older than Methuselah? What man could stand the shock of a change like that? Carnival won't warn you it's equal to post-operative shock, but by God, I bet it is, and more. So what happens? You get your reward. Madness. Change of body, change of personal environment, for one thing. Guilt, for another. Guilt at leaving your wife, husband, friends, to die the way all men die. Lord, that alone would give a man fits. So more fear. More agony for the carnival to breakfast on. So, with the green vapors coming off your stricken conscience, you say you want to go back the way you were. The carnival nods and listens. Yes, they promise, if you behave as they say, in a short while they'll give you back your 20 and 10 or whatever. On the promise alone of being returned to normal old age, that train travels with the world, its sideshow populated with madmen waiting to be released from bondage, meantime servicing the carnival, giving it coke for its ovens. Will murmured something. What?
Miss Foley, mourned Will. Oh, poor Miss Foley. They got her now, just like you say. Once she got what she wanted, it scared her. She didn't like it. Oh, she was crying so hard, Dad, so hard. Now I bet they promise her someday she can be 50 again if she'll mind. I wonder what they're doing with her right now. Oh, Dad! Oh, Jim!
God help her. Will's father put a heavy hand out to trace the old carnival portraits. They've probably thrown her in with the freaks. And what are they? Sinners who've traveled so long, hoping for deliverance, they've taken on the shape of their original sins? The fat man. What was he once? If I can guess the carnival's sense of irony, the way they like to weight the scales, he was once a ravener after all kinds and varieties of lust. No matter. There he lives now anyway, collected up in his bursting skin. The thin man, skeleton or whatever. Did he starve his wife's, children's, spiritual as well as physical hungers? The dwarf? Was he or was he not your friend, the lightning rod salesman, always on the road, never settling, ever moving, facing no encounters? Running ahead of the lightning and selling rods, yes, but leaving others to face the storm, so maybe, through accident or design, when he fell in with the free rides, he shrank not to a boy, but a mean ball of grotesque tripes, all self-involved. The fortune-telling gypsy dust witch? Maybe someone who lived always tomorrow and let today slide, like myself. And so wound up penalized, having to guess other people's wild sunrises and sad sunsets. You tell me you've seen her near. The pinhead, the sheep boy, the fire eater, the Siamese twins, good God, what were they? Twins all bound up in tandem narcissism? We'll never know. They'll never tell. We've guessed, and probably guessed wrong, on 10 dozen things the last half hour. Now, some plan. Where do we go from here? Charles Holloway placed forth a map of the town and drew in the location of the carnival with a blunt pencil. Do we keep hiding out? No, with Miss Foley and so many others involved, we just can't.